Isabel Carmody was in high school when she began writing her fantasy novels, The Oban Newton Chronicles. She was only 14 when she started that first instalment. They're set in a post-apocalyptic world and they follow the young Elspeth, is it Geordie or Geordie?
Geordie, I think.
Geordie, you think so? Who's an orphan with special mental abilities who lives a life of danger and adventure. There have been 6 books in the series, unless you're an American, in which case there have been 7. And Isabel is now putting the finishing touches to the 7th, or if you're American, the 8th, final book. It's called The Red Queen and it will be out when?
Late next year.
Next year, okay. Isabel is also the author of all sorts of other novels, lots of other novels and short stories. She's won many, many awards for her many, many books, at least 18 other novels by my count. Americans may have more. There are 3 collections of short stories and 5 picture books. Hi, Isabel.
Hi. Hi.
What's this thing with the Americans? Why do they have different numbers of books from what the rest of us have?
I think they felt that some of the books were too big for their readers, so they split them because one is 1,000 pages long. So they split it into 2 and then they put it back together as 1. And it's just, it's chaotic out there in the internet land where people are trying to figure out, have they got the next book?
Yes. So we don't know how many books you've written, really.
But
it's sort of like a fantasy thing, isn't it, really? The number of books is kind of negotiable and fluid, depending on which door you come into the room from.
Absolutely.
All right. So I thought that Oban Newton was all done and dusted, but there's more to go.
Just the last one. I'm not sure I'll ever be able to quite let go of it, starting at 14 and still writing it this many years into my life. It's a pretty deep story for me and hopefully for the people reading it.
Well, tell us about Elspeth Geordie. She's a misfit. What does that mean?
It means she doesn't fit in, which is probably why people read the book, because I think most of us go through a stage of feeling like we're a misfit at one point or another. And I grew up very much a misfit. So she was just, at 14, an expression of that feeling and a yearning to find a place in the world, to find a way to exist, to stay myself and yet to fit into the world. And she goes through that same trajectory. I wasn't writing to be published. I was writing to comfort and console myself. But
She's telepathic.
She is. She can communicate with humans over long distances, also with animals.
And that's what makes her a misfit.
It's what I think actually, no, that's the interesting thing. I think she has those abilities, but I think she's actually a very spiky sort of character. I mean, you wonder, what makes you a misfit? Are you a misfit who has special abilities, or are you someone who becomes a misfit because of those special abilities?
But misfit is a category that the authorities put on her, isn't it?
Oh, yes,
that she's categorised
in that
as
world,
a misfit.
Yes.
And as I understand it, she's a misfit because of this freaky ability she's got.
Yeah, absolutely.
She has to be cured of this.
She has to be burned.
Hmm. Yes, well, that would fix you up, wouldn't it? So you say you felt like this. I mean, I suppose sometimes if you're artistic or sensitive or you've got a different life story from everyone else, you do feel different. Are you saying you felt different but special and you wanted to assert that when you were a kid?
No, I just felt powerless like most kids feel.
Right.
And I felt like I wanted to be in a world where I had to do, where I was worth more than the homework I did or the dishes I did. I wanted to change the world. I wanted to be able to do something. And I think it's absolutely common.
But you'd also had an appallingly unfair childhood. It was tough.
Well, I mean, my dad had died in a car crash, but lots of people's parents die, and we were poor. Well, lots of people are poor too. In fact, I was very happy, although often when I speak, people take away the sense that I had a tough childhood. I didn't feel it that way.
Right.
I was really pretty happy.
Okay, so this isn't a story about tragedy. Your own story is not a story about...
No, I don't...
A little girl in tragedy seeking solace in books.
No, no, it wasn't. It was someone exhausted by the world that she lived in with 7 brothers and sisters and just seeking some kind of place to think.
The other thing that's going on when you're a kid, you and I were children in the same, exactly the same time, is the fear of nuclear war. So the USA and the USSR were locked in this terrible compact called Mutually Assured Destruction, which ironically did keep nuclear war at bay. Dr. Strangelove, you know, comes out in 1964. It's the decade of you and my childhood. Now, in this story, the world has been devastated by a nuclear holocaust called the Great White. So were you thinking about that when you were a little girl?
Yeah, for sure. When I was 14 writing the book, we had studied the nuclear bombs dropping on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And as a kid, I just thought how horrendous it was that you would drop a bomb on a city full of old people and children and people in hospital and people who had no power. And I really identified with the powerlessness of the people who were had the bomb dropped on them. And I just thought, are humans ever going to learn? I mean, individually we can be brilliant, we can be wonderful, but as a race it seems to me we're a bit thick some of the time. And I just thought, what would it take at 14? Could I have any hope for the world? And the book for me was a striving towards hope to find out, could I believe people would evolve ethically and morally enough to make different kinds of decisions?
I mean, you're not talking about a race, are you? Talking about a species.
Yes.
That we're a species, yeah.
Yeah.
So she's a strong heroine and she's become stronger with every book.
Yeah, I think you do. I think you struggle and you strive and you do become stronger, but it never ends. The battle to be good, the battle to be better, the battle to be more ethical, the battle to do the right thing in life, in her world, in ours, it doesn't ever end.
So you create this little girl when you're 14, and she's sort of 14 too, is she?
Yes.
So she's your little friend.
Well, if you think about it, she's, you know, people say, why did you write for children? I didn't. I was an adolescent.
Yeah, you wrote for yourself.
I did. I wrote for myself, and I wrote very strongly out of what I felt. And I believe the people who started reading me then, who've grown up very tolerantly with me, I'm often accused of actually waiting till my audience grows up to finish the Obi Newton Chronicles to ensure I have an adult audience. It would have been a great strategy if I'd planned it. But,
yes, you're a very smart little girl.
I know, I was utterly brilliant. No one but me noticed it. But
this is Books and Arts Daily, and I'm talking to Isabel Carmody, and we're talking about her series, which she's been writing since she was a little girl, and she's now a woman of a certain age, and it's all about to come to an end. So this little girl you've created, Elspeth, has been ageing more slowly than you.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah, she has aged. I mean,
How old is she now?
She's about 19.
Right. Oh, that's much slower than you
much,
or I.
Much slower than me. Right. But it is the age of my soul, I suspect. I'm still 19. No, yeah, she's aged at a slower rate because I've taken breaks in her growth. But the fact that she's very much connected to the girl that I was once, and aren't we all the ages that we ever were, one inside the other, like one of those Matryoshka dolls? So I think of her as the doll inside all the dolls, all the ages that I've ever been, and it's still strong.
No, I'm 21 and that's the end of it. There's no other ages.
And, of course, you look 21. That's what I thought.
Thank you very much. Yes, radio is very flattering like that. But what's it done to you? I mean, you're this little girl who you started off the same age as, she's still back there in childhood and you're marching inexorably on, you know, every 365 days you're a year older.
Yeah.
It's
interesting. It's not something I've thought about.
Oh, I'm sorry. I planted it in your mind. Now you go home spooked out about it.
Yeah, no, I think it's because her main striving is to find out something about how human beings exist in the world. And I feel as a writer, if you look at any writer's body of work, I think you can find one or two philosophical questions. And the ones that are under the Obi Newton Chronicles are under everything I write. That's what the themes arise from. And so for me, that aspect of her, that striving to understand, is very much part of what I am now still. So in that sense, we're very strongly connected. And she's a character I love. You know, I want to find out what's going to happen to her next and follow her through. So I haven't got bored with her.
One of the principles that I bring to interviewing people is that at any given time, most of us have only two or three things to say. And some people's things they have to say change over time, and some people remain very grounded in what they've always had to say. Where are you in that? Are the two or three things you had to say when you were a little girl still the things you're saying now?
Well, I think the question of can people evolve ethically and morally is such a huge one that I think I will die still trying to answer it, because the answer is different at different ages too. What I knew and understood of the world at 14 is quite different. So in a way, it's been lovely.
How? Tell me how. Well, let's be specific.
At 14, I thought I would never fit in. I thought I would never have a place. I could never imagine having a child. I didn't want one. I'd had seven brothers and sisters. And I believed, and I was content to be a solitary person. At this point in my life, I have a daughter I would die for. I have a partner I love. I travel over the world. I live in another country. Nothing is the way it looked back then. And yet I'm still not sure of the answer of the question, can we evolve ethically and morally? I want to believe so, all the more because I have a daughter.
But I don't understand why that's a problem. I mean, some people live ethically and some people don't.
it's just a problem just to understand it for me to understand. I mean, I want to.
You mean as a species?
Yeah, not individually. Individually, we've always been able to be incredibly heroic or absolutely cowardly and ghastly. Right. So there's always been those extremes. And in fact, I grapple with those extremes. I sometimes think that's why I write fantasy, because it allows me to stretch out into the extremes and see what, if I want to talk about what we're capable of, to talk about a beast or to talk about an angel, is to look at the extremes of human possibility.
So fantasy isn't a place of escape, it's a place of encounter.
Absolutely. Yeah, you put it absolutely perfectly. I'm always trying to say it's not escapism, it's a stepping back to think. But encounter, yeah, that's perfect.
Mm. Your first interest was in science. I guess there's an element of magic in science.
I think there was an element of curiosity, and that's probably the word that would most describe my personality. I had a Bunsen burner and, you know, one of those bug catchers, and I spent my life looking at the world. But then I discovered you needed maths, and that was the end of my scientific career.
You're the second author today who's had a trouble with maths. There must be. Well, I think there's a story in this. Can writers do maths?
Oh, God, please don't ask me for that.
Quadratic equations, where I parted company with maths. I thought, I don't get this, and I don't think I even need to get it. I just watched the rest of the car sailing off into the world of quadratic equations. Bye.
Someone can do
bye,
that.
Bye, guys.
It doesn't have to be me.
All right. Now, the latest book, which is not in this series, it's a book of longer short stories. It's called Metro Winds. It's got the most lovely apricot-coloured cover with a girl who's got sort of feathers and wings and things running away. Tell us about this. It's these are things you've just written over a period, are they, and you've pulled them together in this collection?
No, I did conceive of the collection 10 years ago. I signed the contract. I take a long time to write short stories. It sounds strange because it takes a really long time for me to write a short story. I've only had two collections. The first one took me 14 years. This took me 10 years. I conceived of it as four stories, but then I was only writing about the ages of women, and I wanted to look at men mythically too, or the fairy tale aspect of it as well. I was looking at sort of fairy. I was trying to push together fairy tales and reality. And I wanted to look at, to begin with, the four mythic ages of women: crone, princess, child, queen, in the right order. And then I just thought it wasn't enough to only, and this is the difference with age too, I no longer want to talk just from the point of view of women. I wanted to look at men as well. So it almost breaks down equally in the stories.
Yeah. Well, one of the stories is called The Man Who Lost His Shadow. There's a man who's very agitated because he realises he's lost his shadow and he goes searching for it and has all sorts of adventures. And I really related to this because when I read Peter Pan, of course, loses his shadow and Wendy has to, well, she tries to sew it back on. And that really, really resonated with me when I was a little boy. And I can remember actually trying to get free of my own shadow. I thought it'd be sort of cool not to have a shadow. I tried to jump up and down and see if I could land before the shadow did. I'm making myself sound strange, aren't I? But
you sound perfect to me. You sound like a character in a story I would write.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's good. Did you have this thing about shadows?
I'm always interested. For me, a shadow is kind of like a metaphor for a part of yourself, the dark. I mean, you always talk about the shadow side, and fantasy plays around with that a lot. And I thought it would be interesting to have a man who'd actually really lost his shadow. And, of course, I was thinking of Peter Pan too.
Mm. Yeah, see, I wouldn't go searching for it. I'd think, this is cool, I don't have a shadow. But he's very, very upset about it, and he goes in search of it. We won't give away what happens. Now, just as we wind up, I wanted to ask you just about the professional business of being a writer, a public figure. I mean, you're very active online. You're a regular at writers' festivals. You talk at schools. You're here today. How important is it for a writer to be a public advocate for her work?
I think it's good if you can speak for what you do, and for the others who haven't got to the same stage yet, you should, if it's possible and you can. If I'm asked, I will. As a writer, it has nothing at all to do with my writing. You have to do it. You have to in this day and age, because it's producing a profile. So if someone goes into the bookshop with their $20 or $30, you would like it that they would look at your book, and you've got a good chance of doing that. So it is important in that way. And for those things. But like I said, it's the flip side of being a writer, which is to be stuck in a room in grungy clothes looking like a witch, you know, handwriting your manuscript.
Yeah. I mean, I think to me one of the issues is that you can't hope that your book will become a thing unto itself from which the writer is separate. That the death of the writer is nonsense. That really in the modern world, the writer and what he or she has to say about their book come as a kind of package.
They do. I mean, in some ways it might be a pity because some people are not great speakers, but they're brilliant writers. And they stand up and maybe they're actually discrediting their own book in a funny sort of way or putting people off. I always hope that doesn't happen when I talk.
Yeah.
And you try and not to let that happen, obviously.
Well, it's been lovely to meet you, and you've done a lovely job, I have to say. So thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Isabel Carmody, her final book in the Obernewton Chronicles, The Red Queen, is out later next year. It'll be published by Penguin, and the new collection of short stories, which isn't for kids, I mean, kids could read it, but it's a wonderful, nourishing adult read, is called Metro Winds, and it's from Allen and Unwin. This is Books and Arts on RN with Michael Cathcart.